crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile, you'd buy expensive shoes, but you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise.
Two things are going to happen during the next 30 seconds. First, you're going to hit play on your music or podcast listening device, which if you're hearing this, you've already done. And second, you're going to hear me introduce Film Book Cast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who is the subject of 20 novels and counting.
Mike Tricchio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. It's nice being a prolific novel character.
Yes, your exploits have been told across time and space. Yep. Which, I mean, you're not a sci-fi character, so that's even more impressive.
Yeah, that's just how good I am.
Now, if you've never listened to a Film Book Cast before, essentially we start with some film news, and then we move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we will move on to our featured review. This week, we are reviewing the new film from director Edward Zwick, Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, which is, of course, the sequel to the 2012 film Jack Reacher, directed by Chris McQuarrie. So that's something. That is. Yeah. I had pretty high hopes for this movie, Mike.
As did I.
And judging by your tone, I feel like you weren't blown away by it.
Yeah, we'll save it for spoilers, Mike.
Yeah, we'll save it for the review.
Yeah,
save it for the review. Give you something to look forward to, listeners. But until we get into that, let's get into some film news.
Hi. It's time for.
What?
It is time for film news on the Film Book Cast today, and there are a few things I wanted to get to because, our last Film Book Cast was a New York Comic Con episode, so we kind of skipped film news that week, so there's a few weeks of film news here to get through. One of the big things that I wanted to talk about, last time we did a film news, we talked about Jon Favreau directing a live-action Lion King remake.
Right.
Well, the live-action Disney remake train has kept on rolling. To a really odd pairing. Guy Ritchie, director of Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels, Snatch, the Sherlock Holmes movies, most recently The Man from U.N.C.L.E., is going to be directing a live-action Aladdin remake.
Just what?
It's one of those headlines you kind of have to read two or three times just to fully grasp what it's trying to say.
Yeah, although I guess it sort of does make sense because Aladdin is a street urchin shoplifting... rooftop chase movie for 20 minutes.
You are saying it is the perfect role for Jason Statham.
Right? Correct.
Jason
That's
Statham
exactly what I mean.
As Guy Ritchie's Aladdin. I can see it. Boy, I'm going to get into the Cave of Wonders, you blatant miscreant.
yes, that's the one.
Christ almighty, I ain't fucking genies.
It's going to be so good.
I'm into this idea of Jason Statham's playing Aladdin. I think Vinny Jones should play the genie.
Yep.
What did Brad Pitt do in Snatch? He was.
He'll be the bare knuckle boxer in this movie. For
he could be the Sultan.
Yeah, there you go.
Brad Pitt could be the Sultan. Basically, I just want like one of Guy Ritchie's London crime dramas set in Disney-fied Agrabah.
I'm in.
That sounds awesome to me. But it's also like. Man, the live-action Disney remake train is really, really weird, isn't it? Like,
yeah, it's bizarre.
And like, I feel like most of the movies are turning out pretty solid, right? Like, The Jungle Book was good, Peach Dragon was good. I heard Cinderella was good. I haven't seen it. I heard mixed things about Maleficent. Really, the only like out-and-out bad ones are the Alice in Wonderland ones, right? I think we can all agree.
Yeah. I mean, the next one we get is Beauty and the Beast. I think right is the next one closest,
and that one's promising. I feel like that. Is a story that could translate well to a live-action movie because it's been done many times already in live-action format. I'm more curious to see what the Lion King remake is going to be like because we were talking about that a couple weeks ago, and they're calling it a live-action remake of Lion King, but it'll just be CGI.
Yeah, I assume. I assume it'll just somehow be like Jungle Book, but there's at least a human character in that. So
yeah, so you could pretend that it's a live action movie in Jungle Book, but
right.
But this, you know, there's no humans in The Lion King. It's going to be, you know, entirely CGI creations. So it's going to be interesting to see how that's going to look and what it's going to be like. But this Aladdin one, I think, is a lot more promising, only because I think Guy Ritchie's a really interesting director, even if he's one that I don't, I'm pretty hit or miss on his movies. Right. But that's, like, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was solid. I enjoyed that one. He's coming out with his King Arthur movie next.
Right.
With Charlie Hunnam as King Arthur.
Still trying to make him a thing.
Still trying to make Charlie Hunnam a thing. It's, you know. It's like Mean Girls, you know. You gotta stop trying to make Charlie Hunnam happen. It's just not gonna happen. But that's at least that's an interesting Disney remake in the future. They've talked about like Tim Burton's Dumbo. We've talked about that. I don't think that's right.
Wasn't there a P.T. Anderson Pinocchio at one point?
That wasn't Disney, but that was gonna happen at some point. I think he dropped out of that.
Yeah.
But they're trying to do a Mulan remake soon.
Yes.
And there was this big story recently because Ang Lee turned down the director chair for Mulan. And it was like Disney had put out a statement that said, like, oh, we're looking specifically for Asian directors to tell this story. And they immediately went to the most prominent Asian director. and he turned them down.
Denied.
Yeah. So we'll see. We will see what happens with these movies. But I think the Aladdin one is the most promising, although I think the Lion King one just got the fast track. So. That might be Beauty and the Beast is next. I know that much. And then I think The Lion King might be after that. I didn't know they're doing a sequel to The Jungle Book as well. You know, we'll see what happens. But if Jason Statham's playing Aladdin, I am there opening day. Yeah.
Your butt is in the seat.
Yeah, we got to fetch this lamp from from the fucking Cave of Wonders, man.
Yes, I'm there for that.
If I can write all of Jason Statham's dialogue in the movie.
Then even better.
I'm all for it. And then the next bit of film news, this just came out yesterday, 2 days ago. Sean Levy is the latest director attached to the Uncharted movie, which is going to be written by Joe Carnahan. Now, the fact that Joe Carnahan was writing this movie was announced back in June. Sean Levy is a director who has directed the Night at the Museum films. He directed Real Steel. Most recently, he produced Stranger Things and directed, I think, the first two episodes of Stranger Things, and will be directing more in season two. But the Uncharted movie has been quite a ride to anybody anybody who's been following this development. Now, we're both huge fans of the Uncharted series of video games.
Yes.
And so the Uncharted movie dates back to, I think, 2009 or 2010, around the time that Uncharted 2 came out. So he was trying to push for an Uncharted movie because one of the big selling points of the games is that they're like video game versions of movies. Like they're basically pretty Indiana much. Jones the game, you know, with a little bit of National Treasure thrown in there.
That's the perfect way to describe it.
And so, you know, this dates back to 2010. Originally, this movie had David O. Russell attached to direct it, who is the director of movies like The Fighter and Silver Linings Playbook. You know, he's a hugely prestigious director, like way above his pay. Like he is way above the pay grade of an Uncharted movie.
I believe Mark Wahlberg was attached to star at one point.
Mark Wahlberg was supposed to star supposedly as Nathan Drake, although I was also going to star Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci as Drake's father and uncle.
Oh my god.
And it basically would have been an Uncharted movie in name only, I feel like.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have any resemblance to the game. It might have been a good movie.
Although now I really wanted Robert De Niro Sully.
Exactly.
In joke for anyone who's played the games, I guess.
And then after that, David O. Russell dropped out like a year later. Neil Berger jumped on to direct. Neil Berger was the director of Limitless, and recently he directed Divergent, the first one. And that's like the level of director I would have expected for this kind of thing. And this was right after Limitless came out, which was a pretty big hit when it first came out too. Limitless was pretty like a solid hit, and I remember thinking Bradley Cooper would actually be a pretty good fit for Nathan Drake. I could see it.
Yeah, he would. You're right.
And so that never materialized. And then Seth Gordon was the director of this movie. And Seth Gordon was the director of movies like Horrible Bosses, The King of Kong, and a couple other things, mostly comedies. And he is like a work for hire guy. Like, you know, he's fine. It's whatever. That didn't happen either. So it's been a tumultuous time for Uncharted fans who want a movie. And even then, I don't know how many Uncharted fans really want a movie that badly, because the games basically fulfill any narrative issues they might want.
Yeah, I think I've hit the point now that I've finished the fourth one, you know, and the story is wrapped up in a neat little bow. I'm not sure I want a movie anymore. Like, I had wanted one for a long time.
Yeah.
But what else? It's just going to be the movie version of the games? Like, what?
Yeah.
Are movies? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, and Sean Levy's a guy who I'm not a huge fan of. Like, you know, he's mostly not... He's a work-for-hire dude. He's a guy who, he did all three Night of the Museums. He did Real Steel. I mentioned all this before. But the thing that does intrigue me about this movie is that it's written by Joe Carnahan this time. And this movie's also gone through several screenplay drafts, I will point out as well. But Joe Carnahan was hired to write this movie back in June. And Joe Carnahan's a director who I really like. He directed The Gray. He directed Smoke and Aces. What I think this movie should be tonally is probably closer to Joe Carnahan's The A-Team movie, which came out in 2010 with Liam Neeson and Charlton Copley and Bradley Cooper, actually. That's a very underrated action movie, I think. The A-Team is a lot of fun. I don't know if you've seen The A-Team.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Okay. It's a fun time. It's a very enjoyable blockbuster.
And I think you're totally right. That's exactly the tone that an Uncharted movie needs.
Yeah. And so the fact that Joe Carnahan is writing this does give me hope. It gives me a slimmer of hope. He's not I would rather he be writing and directing this, but he's actually busy directing Bad Boys 3. Taking over the prestigious role from Michael Bay.
I'll take sentences I never thought I'd hear for 500 hours.
But that is what's going on. So that's the way it is. So Uncharted, phenomenal video game series. I'm a huge fan of the games. Movies, I'm up in the air about. But the fact that Joe Carnahan's writing, even though Sean Levy's directing, gives me pause. Gives me hope.
Yep.
One might say. In the darkest of times, in the Snyderverse, there's
a glimmer of light.
And then the next film news story I've got, this is a pretty huge casting news get. I'm pretty excited about this. Donald Glover has been cast as a young Lando Calrissian.
In Trek 5.
You son of...
I had to do it. It was too good.
Donald Glover has been cast as the donkey in Trek 5. They recast Eddie Murphy.
Yep.
Because they were very upset about his attitude at the 2006 Oscars when he didn't win for Dreamgirls. DreamWorks is like, no more. So they recast him with Donald Glover. No, Donald Glover is playing Lando Calrissian in Phil Lord and Chris Miller's Han Solo movie, which is, of course, the Star Wars spinoff coming out in 2018. And that is an amazing casting choice. I am so excited. Yeah. That's
mind
one of those things that was rumored a while ago, like a few months ago. It came out like, oh, Donald Glover might be Lando, and as soon as that was rumored, I was like, he has to be. I can't picture anyone else doing it if they're going to have young Lando. And you know, this is a movie that started out as such a bad idea, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it did. Real bad.
You know, spinoff about a young Han Solo. You know, Harrison Ford's performance as Han Solo is iconic. How could anybody live up to it? You know, prequels in Star Wars, like, those always go well. But then they hired Phil Lord and Chris Miller to make this movie, who make great movies out of exclusively bad ideas. And so, you know, that gave me hope. And then they cast Alden Ehrenreich as Han Solo, who's a really great actor who I think could really do the part really well. So that gave me hope. And now Donald Glover is being cast as young Lando. That's even better. And also, this movie's being written by Lawrence Kasdan Jake Kasdan. Lawrence Kasdan wrote Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
As well as, I think, Return of the Jedi. And he wrote Force Awakens as well. He co-wrote Force Awakens.
Yep.
So that's very exciting. This movie's really coming together, I think. And Donald Glover is just one of the best, elements about this. Like, and he's a really talented person. Atlanta is one of the best shows on TV right now. I really love that show.
Other than Lin-Manuel Miranda, I think Donald Glover has the next highest chance of an EGOT.
That is quite possible, actually, because Donald Glover is also a musician. He's Childish Gambino.
Yeah. Yep.
So it could happen. It could happen.
It's possible. You never know.
Yeah, it could definitely happen. So that's really exciting casting news. I'm really stoked about that. I think that Han Solo movie is just really exciting. The whole, the Star Wars universe going forward is just a very exciting time because you got Gareth Edwards' Rogue One coming out in just a couple months, which is a cool story, and it's given Gareth Edwards a cool chance to do something cool, hopefully. Episode 8 directed by Rian Johnson, which is awesome, and then you got this Phil Lord and Chris Miller movie, which is gonna be cool too. So
yeah, this the Han Solo movie originally sounded like the most just blatant cash grab. I mean, I guess they're all cash grab, but
right.
the most low effort cash grab,
yeah,
because Rogue One seems like it's gonna be a bold, like, weird choice for what the Star Wars universe is.
Rogue One is centered on characters who aren't in other Star Wars movies.
Right.
And it's just a cool, different choice. This is like a different thing because it's being focused on somebody we already know. And it's like, that's not – and when it was first announced, I was like, that's not really what I want. I want more movies like Rogue One. You know,
exactly, yeah. And then, like you said, as we've gotten more and more information and casting and names attached to it, it's like, okay, this actually could – this. I think this is going to be really cool.
This could really work, hopefully. So that's pretty exciting. We'll see what happens about that in 3 years. Or two years now, 2 years, 2018. And then finally, last bit of film news. There's a big hullabaloo over the past few days on the internet. Because Tim Miller, the director of Deadpool and no other movies, has left Deadpool 2 over creative differences with Ryan Reynolds. This caused a pretty big stir on the internet, on Twitter and stuff. Because people were like, I think people are just very fragile when it comes to
choose your words wisely.
I'm saying people seem to be very fragile when it comes to like when anything like the slightest bit of news that could possibly disrupt a movie in its production comes out, the internet loses its fucking mind. So like
you're not wrong.
So in like Rogue One went for reshoots, right?
Right.
Like people they were like, oh yeah, Rogue One's going back for some reshoots because you know we need to you know reshoot some stuff. Some stuff wasn't working, so we reshot it. The internet was like, oh man, Rogue One sucks.
I think because you're right that that's definitely a thing that happens, and it's because the general public, I guess, was never alerted to like how often these kinds of things are, and then now we associate it with what movies this year do we know that went back for reshoots? Suicide Squad and Batman vs Superman.
Yeah, and that's true, but also
reshoots meet the death of everything.
But almost every movie goes for reshoots.
Oh, I know. Yeah, absolutely. But that's what it's like, they become associated with the bad things.
Exactly. And so the internet tends to lose its mind whenever the slightest thing happens in the production of a movie that could cause problems in the movie. And Tim Miller leaving Deadpool has caused a huge stir. Because people are very upset about Tim Miller leaving Deadpool. And that blew my mind. Because, I mean, we both liked Deadpool. I think you liked it more than I did. But I thought it was a solid, fun time. Tim Miller's direction is not the reason I liked Deadpool.
Right.
You know? In fact, I thought it actively hampered Deadpool. I thought, you know, that's a very visually flat movie, I think. And it's kind of boring to look at. And, you know, the only locations in the movie are a bridge and, like, a parking lot. Like, you know, it's...
to be fair, that's probably budgetary. But, yeah, you're totally right.
It is partially budgetary, but there's, like, it's still, like, a $40 to $50 million movie. There's more locations. There's ways to make it look interesting, you know?
Yeah. I think also, too, people who, quote-unquote, are not in the know... just associate the director with ultimate power on like they do everything, you know what I mean?
Right.
So losing the director of the movie they want, it's like that movie's never going to get made now. I don't know. Maybe that's what people think.
Yeah, people are treating this like it's like Edgar Wright leaving Ant-Man, like it was this huge thing. Like Edgar Wright's like a true visionary director. Tim Miller is just a guy.
Just a dude behind a camera.
And I don't mean to discount Tim Miller as a director. Like, again, he's only directed Deadpool. That's his only movie that he's ever directed. He's directed a couple of, like, short films for commercials and stuff. Like, I think he did a thing for DC Universe Online and stuff like that. He's a visual effects artist before this and has done visual effects work. But, like, this was his directorial debut. And so I don't really have that much to judge his talent on other than Deadpool, and I didn't really see that much of it in Deadpool. Supposedly the big creative difference with this movie is that he and Ryan Reynolds kept fighting over who they were going to cast as Cable in Deadpool 2. Supposedly Tim Miller wanted Kyle Chandler for the role, and Reynolds wanted to go with somebody who was more appropriate for what the character is like in the comics. So Kyle Chandler as Cable would be very different than what it's like in the comics, but it could have been a really interesting thing. It could have been a very interesting twist. And supposedly there was a lot of turmoil between the two on the actual set of Deadpool in the making of the movie.
Right. I had heard also that he wanted to make a more straight ahead action movie and Ryan Reynolds like wouldn't allow it, but like wanted to keep more what Deadpool is or was in the first one. You know?
I had heard that as well. And, but at the same time, I think there is some kind of merit to the fact that if the budget for Deadpool ballooned sky high, like if the Deadpool 2 budget was significantly higher than the Deadpool 1 budget, I think you could have a lot of fun making fun of that in the movie. You know, and make like Deadpool was like a down dirty, like kind of grimy superhero movie. Like it's not very flashy. And I feel like if he's gonna make like a big blockbuster version of Deadpool, like that could be a really interesting parody of modern superhero blockbusters, more so than Deadpool 1 was, because most modern superhero blockbusters are these like overblown CGI spectacles.
And now they could do that and then make fun of it.
Yeah, they could take the piss out of it. And, you know, this like Deadpool 2 will make money. It's like,
yeah,
that's not the problem. So I don't know. I mean, this whole thing, like, I don't really care that Tim Miller left. You know, Ryan Reynolds is still there, and Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, who wrote the movie and wrote the script, like, kept like those three guys, Reynolds, Rhett Reese, and Paul Wernick, kept this movie alive for years. And so they're probably the authorities on who's on what they want to do here.
Just let Ryan Reynolds direct it. It'll be fine.
I really hope that doesn't
happen. Has he ever directed anything? I don't know.
I don't think so, but I feel like it might just turn into like a vanity project then, like William Shatner directing Star Trek V.
You know? Oh my God. Like, yeah.
But so who should direct Deadpool 2, do you think, Mike? Because there's a fan petition right now to get Quentin Tarantino to direct Deadpool 2. And I absolutely don't want that in the slightest.
No, I think I saw another people calling out for Matthew Vaughn, right? Does he direct Kick-Ass?
Matthew Vaughn directs Kick-Ass and directs Kingsman. He would actually probably be a pretty good fit for this, although he is doing Kingsman 2 at the moment. So I don't think he...
Right.
is available, and also I would rather him do his own thing too. I think he's too talented for Deadpool 2.
Well, it would be interesting to see, like you said, if it blew up into this action blockbuster movie, to have his touch to it would be cool. I don't know.
But the petition for Tarantino got a lot of hits online. Like, it got passed around on Twitter a lot, and it just seems like the worst possible idea to me.
Yeah,
It seems like somebody like thought of like, who could direct Deadpool 2? Hey, Quentin Tarantino movies have a lot of blood. Tarantino's movies have so much more depth than Deadpool. You know, they're not just dick jokes. Like,
although I did just have a really funny mental image of like Deadpool
shouting sitting the word a lot.
Well, yeah. Deadpool sitting at a table as the camera spins around the table, giving Tarantino-esque dialogue.
And that would be cool. But like, Tarantino would make a Tarantino movie. He wouldn't necessarily make the movie that fans of Deadpool want to see.
Absolutely.
And so, as for who I think should direct Deadpool 2, I think actually a very good choice would be Mark Neville Dean and Brian Taylor, who were the directors of Crank.
Oh my God.
And Crank 2 and Ghost Rider 2 as well. They did Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance. And like, Ghost Rider 2 is not great, but like, they have a very kinetic style. Like, they have a distinctive style that I think would very much fit in with Deadpool 2. And I think they can compromise and like, kind of where like, they're not great auteurs that I wouldn't want to see wasting their time on a Deadpool movie. You know, they're like cool visual directors. Also, I think Yorma Taccone from the Lonely Island would be a good choice too. Really? Director of MacGruber, director of Popstar. I think, you know, he's a good comedy director and he has a good visual cinematic eye. I think Deadpool 2 would be good too for him. But I think Neville Dean Taylor would be my dream choice for Deadpool 2. Like, that's to me the perfect marriage of filmmaker and material there.
Yeah, I'm in.
All right.
Let's get on to our discussions, I believe.
Yeah, all right. So that about wraps up film news, guys. Let's move on into our discussions. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it is time for our discussions. Mike, what if you have to discuss for us today?
All right, for today I got two things. Big week for me.
Oh boy.
Yeah, buckle up. So the first thing I want to talk about is The Accountant, the latest Ben Affleck movie, directed by a person who I can't remember.
Gavin O'Connor is the director.
Yeah, there you go.
He's the director of Warrior.
Right.
He's a producer on The Americans. He directed Jane Got a Gun earlier this year.
Yeah, I remember that movie. It was a thing we almost reviewed. So The Accountant it got a lot of hate. I saw
it got mixed reviews.
Mixed reviews, yeah. On the Slash Filmcast, they pretty much pooped on it pretty hard. Which is pretty funny. But it's all right. It's pretty middle of the road. It takes, Ben Affleck plays a person on the spectrum who's an accountant for the most evil humans alive. There's this weird subplot with the Treasury Department trying to find who he is. And that's kind of it.
Okay.
It does have a weird twisty-turny plot with keeps you on your toes, but kind of a lot of it seems to be twists for the sake of twists. Like, this could have been a very straightforward action movie. And I think David Chen makes that case that if this movie from the Slash Film Cast had taken the John Wick route and just been like, we're a silly, straight for the action, let's do this kind of movie, it would have been a much bigger hit instead of trying to be this weird, dramatic, keep you guessing, flat, windy thing. And it just kind of bungles it and fails at what it's trying to do. And I think I do agree with that. It's when there is this weird, these action sequences that seem to just literally happen out of nowhere.
Right.
They're awesome. They're really well choreographed. It's a lot of fun. But when we're trying to see this emotionless Ben Affleck character like have a meaningful conversation, it feels really weird. So I guess that's my take on The Accountant. It's okay. It's a middle of the road action movie with some weird plot stuff. So I guess take that for what it's worth.
All right. Cool. And what's your other discussion, Mike?
My other discussion is The Walking Dead.
Okay.
Which, I'm, 8 years late to this party, I guess.
Just, the coolest people show up to the party 8 years late, though.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I know you were all waiting for me, so now we can resume. The Walking Dead was a show I watched when I was watching live during season one and two. And then about halfway through season two, we took 8 episodes to do one thing. And I was like, nope, I'm out. And I pulled the ripcord on that season.
Yes. You are, of course, referring to the Herschel's Farm season, which is terrible.
Yeah, right. But then there was all this hubbub around the premiere of season 7 that just happened recently as of recording this.
Yes.
And I said, I'll only give it a chance. However many millions of people can't be wrong, right?
But they can be.
But they can be, and they kind of are.
This explains why Donald Trump is still a presidential candidate. Boom. Topical.
Hot take. so I wanted to go back. They're all up. The 6 seasons are all up on Netflix. So I've been watching, trying to marathon to catch up. I didn't make it in time for the premiere of season 7, which is fine. I'm not worried about it.
So how far are you in the show right now?
I am currently midpoint of season 5.
Okay.
I think around episode 7 or 6 or 7 or 8, somewhere around there. We're dealing with the hospital in Atlanta. That's the plot point, I guess.
Yes.
And I think so far, my biggest complaint with the show is just a pacing issue. It's 16 episodes a season, which in 2016 is way too many. For a show this intense and dramatic, and with this many plot lines, it can't help but bear the comparison to Game of Thrones, which handles its varying plots way more interestingly and intense.
Yeah, I mean, Game of Thrones is also a show that has a lot more depth, too. I think there's...
Right, I guess that's what I'm saying. Like, if Walking Dead was in the hands of more capable writers, maybe? I'm not really... Not that, it's bad writing, but...
I've been watching The Walking Dead from the beginning. I've almost quit a few times, but I keep coming back for some reason.
Right. Basically, there's 3 episodes a season that are really good, which is the premiere, the mid-season finale, and then the season finale. And there's a couple of usually other good things happening in there. But a lot of the times, my most recent thing we were talking about before we started recording, season 5 starts off at Terminus, and there's this crazy... I don't know. Does spoilers matter for this? I don't know. This weird...
That was 2 years ago. It's fine.
Yeah. With cannibals and crazy shit, and they're hunting each other down through the forest and at this church, and it's 3 awesome episodes. And then we slam the emergency brakes on to go spend time at this hospital with Beth. We set up all this really awesome tension and drama and pacing only to stop and have weird flashback episodes. And and that was my issue with season 2 when I stopped watching, was we... are wasting our time doing these other things.
Yes.
Said it was saving up the stuff for the season, mid-season finale, and then we waste our time and save up action and drama for the season finale, which is what bothers me about this these seasons being 16 episodes long.
Yeah, in most cases, I would say The Walking Dead seasons should be shorter. The reason I stick with the show, I think, is because I think it's a very well-directed show, and it's a very... like, visually, it looks very good.
Yeah.
I think before you started rewatching it, I told you, like, The Walking Dead is not a good show except when it is.
Right.
And there are times when I think The Walking Dead is legitimately great, and it's awesome. It's, like, one of the best things on TV. And there are so many other times where I'm just like, why am I still watching this? This persisted up until this past Sunday with the premiere of Season 7, which you haven't seen yet. I won't go into spoilers. But, you know, it's pretty common pop culture knowledge at this point that Season 6 of Walking Dead ended on a huge cliffhanger, promising the death of one of its characters, and basically stopped mid-scene.
Right.
And, you know, Season 7 kind of picks up where it leaves off and shows you who died. But it feels so much more like a marketing move, and it ruins the impact that those deaths would have. And I feel like that's such a huge problem with the show in general, is impactful deaths are really hard to come by on The Walking Dead. Like, when every once in a while, there is a great, great death scene on the show.
Yeah.
I think, you haven't reached my favorite one yet, actually, which is the episode 9 of season 5, I think.
Okay.
But it's a really tremendously handled death. Although you have reached Bob's death, which I thought was very good.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, Bob's death was very good. I thought Herschel's death was very well executed. But so many, so many other times.
Oh, what a terrible choice of words, Mike.
Fair enough. But so many other times, you know, the death always feels like it's for shock value. Rather than for setting a story into motion or, you know, having it affect other characters. You know, that bugs me. That really bugs me. And that's something that Game of Thrones has occasionally done, like go for a death for shock value. But most of the time in Game of Thrones, I feel like the deaths matter, you know?
Right.
Like when a character dies on Game of Thrones, I feel impacted by it and it impacts the world around them or it impacts the characters.
Things change after character deaths, usually, on Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
In Walking Dead, a character death just means we're going to get a new character to come in eventually.
Yeah, especially like, if it's a black character who dies, a new black character shows up.
Yeah. work on your issues there, Walking Dead.
I do think The Walking Dead got better with that as it went on. Like, it's one of the most diverse shows on TV now.
It has, even by season 5, that's way less of an issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, R.I.P. T-Dog.
My man, T-Dog. I hope the end of the show is T-Dog coming back from the dead and turning out to be the secret hero. Like he knew the cure for zombies the whole time.
But nobody
ever asked him because he's always in the background not saying anything in the scenes that he's in.
Yep.
So nobody thought to ask him.
Even some of the twists like are pretty obvious. I think. I don't know about spoilers. I guess it's not spoilers because season 5, like we said, has come out a while ago. But like the Eugene reveal that he is actually just lying about how he knows the cure.
Right.
Like called that as soon as he shows up. Like it's pretty obvious. You know what I mean? And that happened. That takes a season before we find that we get that reveal. I mean, it's just a pacing issue for a lot of this is my complaint about Walking Dead. Other than that, it is a pretty fun, gory, gross look at these crazy characters. Everyone is just constantly greasy, which is kind of cool. Like it makes sense, you know. But it seems to just hammer on the mundane stuff of like zombie apocalypse. Is like, yeah, a lot of it's just waiting around, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's not entertaining TV for the most part.
Yeah,
and they're not the episodes aren't written or given enough depth to make that interesting.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's a great movie to be made with these characters, but I feel like a TV show is the wrong format for this kind of story. Like, a zombie story works because it's, you know, tightened, you know, like, The Walking Dead, I think, is the only zombie show on TV, right? I mean, I don't know if it's the only zombie show, but it's, like, obviously the biggest example of one.
Right. It's the only, I think, zombie apocalypse show.
Right.
There's, like, that weird iZombie where it's, like,
There is iZombie, which I've heard is actually very good. And I guess technically Ash vs. Evil Dead, although those are more demons than than zombies.
If we're going to get technical about it.
Put on my glasses. So, I mean, I feel like a zombie apocalypse story can be very compelling. There are so many great zombie movies, but I feel like it's not the best vehicle for an ongoing TV show story.
Right.
At a certain point, it's just wallowing in misery porn.
Yeah.
Which is definitely something that I felt like the season premiere had in spades, was misery porn.
Which is... Yeah, the thing I've heard of everyone's like, has Walking Dead gone too far? about season 7, but like there's some pretty, like, one of the episodes in season 5 I just watched, they're in Atlanta and we, you know, they turn to like a big parking lot that's clearly been napalmed, and it's just a parking lot full of partially melted zombies stuck to the floor.
Right.
Like that's pretty graphic.
Yeah.
Like,
and to its credit, The Walking Dead I think has the best makeup effects prosthetics on TV anywhere. Like, it's, and Greg Nicotero, who does the makeup for the show, he also directs a lot of episodes. He's a significant voice in the show. He's been a Hollywood makeup artist for years, and so I mean, I saw, like, I went to the Walking Dead panel at Comic-Con and I saw him and I like geeked out. I was like, "Hey, it's Greg Nicotero."
Right.
You know, he's a great makeup artist, but and yeah.
Yeah, and it definitely, that is, a lot of times it feels like there's scenes or moments just for them to show off, like, look how gross we can make this thing.
Like, oh yeah, 100%,
which is awesome, which is cool. Every time a zombie gets his head stomped on, we have to have the scene of the boot smushing the skull. Like, sure. Like, why not?
We didn't get it the first 40 times, so we got to do it again,
right? Yeah, so that's my welcome to the Walking Dead cast, I guess. If anything, every time we talk about Walking Dead, it turns into a half-hour conversation. So
that is true.
If it's worth anything, it's worth talking about The Walking Dead.
Yeah, so. it's a great show to complain about. Is the thing, because there's so much stuff that's good in it, but the stuff that's bad in it really weighs it down.
Yeah.
But in any case, that's The Walking Dead. You know, we gotta get off this. I went to great pains to stop covering The Walking Dead for Film Book, and I don't want to go back. So let's move on into my discussions.
It's going to be my discussion every episode now.
I got a couple things I want to talk about for discussion today. The first of which is The Lobster, which is the new movie from director Yorgos Lanthimos, who was the director of Dogtooth, which is a movie that I really love. Have you seen Dogtooth, Mike?
No, I have not.
Okay. It's a Greek movie about this family who, and the father of the family does not allow the children or the wife to go outside of the house at all.
Okay.
And so their entire understanding of culture is based on what their father allows them to experience. And so they have, like, really weird traditions that they think are totally normal. All they know about the outside world is watching the movie Jaws and Rocky. And it's a really dark comedy kind of movie. It's very weird and surreal. And it's I've shown it to people before. It gets gross at certain points. And, like, people have, like, gotten mad at me for showing it to them. this is the new movie from Yorgos Lanthimos. It's his first English movie, and this stars Colin Farrell, Rachel Weisz, John C. Reilly, Lea Seydoux, and Ben Whishaw, among a few others. And this takes place in a world in which everyone must be in a relationship, and if you're not in one, you get sent on a retreat where you have 45 days to meet a new partner, and if you don't find a new partner, you get turned into an animal of your choosing.
Sure.
So this is a, I thought this was a very effective, kind of light sci-fi, dark comedy that feels very in line with Dogtooth. I think its portrayal of dating and building relationships and its depiction of finding love is something I thought was oddly poignant. even if it's kind of tough to pin down why, and it's just kind of weird and surreal. Colin Farrell is doing great work here, too. He plays an overweight, kind of pathetic character. And it's kind of unlike what we normally see Colin Farrell doing. When I see Colin Farrell, I picture, like, you know, the guy... like a blockbuster leading man type dude, or, you know, somebody who's in over his head, like in Bruges or Seven Psychopaths or something.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I really enjoy The Lobster. I thought it was very funny, very kind of interesting, and it's really weird in its own way, and it's very surreal. It explores the concepts basically to its completion. Like, it has a lot of interesting stuff to do, and there's a lot of the world to explore that I didn't even think about when I – read the synopsis of this movie. So it's really, really solid. Very well done. The reason it's called The Lobster is because that's Colin Farrell's animal of choice.
Makes sense.
Naturally. And that plays into some pretty heavy symbolism toward the end of the movie, which I found very endearing. But in any case, that's The Lobster. The other movie I wanted to talk about is called Roar. And this is a movie directed by Noel Marshall, who also stars in the movie, along with his family, which includes his wife, Tippi Hedren, who was the star of The Birds, and daughter Melanie Griffith. And this is a movie that was made in 1981, but never got a real release until last year, when Drafthouse Films kind of rediscovered it and decided to distribute it. Now, here's the thing. The movie is not that good, but the making of this movie is fascinating. So this movie is centered on a family that travels to Africa and is attacked by lots and lots of wild animals. It's an exploitation movie, basically. Here's the thing. They used real animals on set.
What?
With no way of maintaining safety. and so we are talking hundreds of lions.
Oh, my God.
Tigers, leopards, cheetahs, panthers, even a few elephants. And, you know, it was independently financed. It wasn't in part of the studio system. I don't think a studio would allow this kind of thing to happen. And it took about 11 years to finish. And in that time, 70 members of the cast and crew sustained injuries, many of them life-threatening.
And, oh, my God.
And many of them are included in the movie. There are scenes in this movie when you are seeing lions rip people apart, and they're actually ripping people apart.
Holy shit. That's crazy.
Yeah, and nobody died. Nobody died during the making of this movie. They just got really brutally hurt. But, like, Melanie Griffith was mauled by a lion and had to get 50 stitches to her face and almost lost an eye in the making of this movie. Tippi Hedren fractured her leg after falling off of an elephant. Director Noel Marshall, who stars in the movie, also got gangrene. From being attacked over and over and over again. And the cinematographer of this movie was Jan de Bont, who was the director of Speed. And he had his scalp lifted by a lion.
My God.
And had to get 220 stitches around his head to put his scalp back.
Okay, I need to watch this movie.
So here's the thing. The movie's not great. It's... like,
yeah,
but
I mean,
but it is like a weird testament to artistic passion that I kind of have to admire.
Remember, we all thought Boyhood was so crazy because it took 12 years.
Yeah, nobody got mauled by a lion on the set of Boyhood.
70 people weren't attacked on that movie.
Yeah, I the movie's not great. I probably wouldn't watch it again, but I would gladly watch a making of documentary or read a behind the scenes about this because I'm sure it is insane.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It aired on TCM at like 2 in the morning, which is how I watched this.
Perfect.
So if you have the opportunity to watch Roar, I would say at least like watch it for the interest of it. Like the weird fascination that I have with this movie is, I think, worth checking out. But definitely look into the making of this movie, because this movie is nuts. Like, just the fact that this stuff happened is insane. And it was all for the art, man. And the weird thing is, this movie was actually made as, like, a wildlife preservation film. Like, it even... The movie actually opens with a credit that reads something along the lines of, like... it has, like, directed by Noel Marshall and written by... And then it says written by... And then it has, like, a message. And it said, due to the fact that so many animals partook in this movie... it's only fair that they get credit too.
Oh my God.
And so all of the animals are credited as writers of the movie. And it kind of ends with like this plea, like, you know, preserve the wildlife in Africa, which is weird when you just watched a movie about the wildlife in Africa, literally killing people.
Right. Insane.
So it feels very odd and wrongheaded, but at the same time, it's just so bold and weird. And the years and the pain and suffering that went into making this movie is something to behold. So that's Roar. Check it out if you can. It's super, super weird. All right. Should we move on, Mike?
I think we should.
Okay. Let's move on to our featured review of Jack Reacher, Never Go Back.
Two things are going to happen in the next 90 seconds.
Excuse me?
First, that phone over there is going to ring. Second, you're going to be wearing these cuffs on your way to prison.
Well, that is one magnificent prophecy, Mr. Reacher.
Just gonna keep on ringing.
Thanks for tipping us off to that sheriff.
When are you coming to D.C.?
I move around a lot.
You're a legend.
Folks wonder why you left.
Purple Heart, Silver Star.
There's this big dent in the desk. People say you made it with someone's head.
Jack Reacher for Major Turner.
Major Turner's been arrested.
On what charge?
Espionage.
He's been set up. How much does Reacher know?
How's it going?
I want being followed.
All right, that was from the trailer for Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, which was written by Richard Wank, Edward Zwick, and Marshall Herskovitz, and directed by Edward Zwick. This movie stars Tom Cruise, Colby Smulders, Aldous Hodge, Danica Yarosh, Patrick Huisinger, Colt McCallany, and Robert Knepper, among others, and the IMDb plot synopsis of this movie reads, Jack Reacher must uncover the truth behind a major government conspiracy in order to clear his name. On the run as a fugitive from the law, Reacher uncovers a potential secret from his past that could change his life forever.
Well, that was a really in-depth plot synopsis
sounds,
from IMDb.
Yeah, sounds pretty intense coming from IMDb. So I'm a big fan of the original Jack Reacher. Mike, I think you like that movie too?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a very good movie. I think it's a very like tightly directed thriller with a lot of very clever elements, memorable set pieces, Tom Cruise kicking ass, and a very fun villain portrayed by Werner Herzog, of all people. I really love that original Jack Reacher movie. I actually own it on Blu-ray. It's a good time. I haven't seen it probably since in a couple of years. Although it was playing on FX a lot over the past few days, obviously, because Jack Reacher 2 is coming out. And so I would pop in here and there, and I was still into it. Like, I think it's very cool. I was bummed that the series would continue without Chris McQuarrie, who directed the first one, who I think really made that movie work beyond its kind of action movie version of Law & Order premise, you know?
Right.
Which that's is kind exactly of... what it is. Yeah, that's kind of what it is. And, of course, I'm psyched that Chris McQuarrie is now on the Mission Impossible bandwagon. Like, he's kicking that now. Yeah. And he crushed it with Rogue Nation, and I'm sure he'll crush it again with Mission Impossible 6. So, I'm happy that he is where he is, but I'm a little bummed that Jack Reacher has to suffer. So, and I love Tom Cruise as an action star as well. This movie had at least that going for it, right? That Tom Cruise was starring in this movie.
Right.
Right, like, at a base level, I can get behind that, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
He brought on Edward Zwick as a director, who he had worked with on The Last Samurai. Zwick also directed movies like Glory, Blood Diamond, Love and Other Drugs, and most recently Pawn Sacrifice. And man, this movie fell really flat for me.
Jack Reacher?
Yeah, Jack Reacher.
Or Pawn Sacrifice.
I did not see Pawn Sacrifice.
I did not see Pawn Sacrifice,
although you could say that was a checkmate
of
a movie. That doesn't mean anything.
This sure, is... you could.
You could, but would you?
Yeah.
But yeah, man, this movie really fell really flat for me. Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. What did you think of coming out of the theater for this?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. This felt like, this is just another action movie with Tom Cruise beating people up in a not so interesting way, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think there are like a few good scenes peppered throughout of this movie, a few of which are in the trailer, which is and they play out like in full in the trailer too, which is kind of disappointing. But the whole thing just kind of lacks energy. And like the first one seemed like a superior version of a CBS procedural cop drama.
Yeah. And, your action movie Law and Order is pretty spot on.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like exactly what it is.
Yeah. So that felt like a superior version of that. This felt like a regular version of a CBS procedural cop drama, you know? This felt like NCIS the movie. Tom Cruise is solid, as always. Like, he's good in the movie, although he doesn't... even he kind of seems checked out at certain points, you know? I feel like he's not as invested in this one as he was in the first one. And there's no, like, standout stunt sequence in this movie that would kind of entice me to recommend this. You know, like, the first film has that car chase in which Cruise did all the driving. It's a great car chase. Like, it's really impeccably directed and really well done. And, like, you know, all the Mission Impossible movies have, you know, crazy, incredible stunts that Tom Cruise does all the time. And he does all his own stunts. He does that kind of stuff himself whenever he can. And so this movie doesn't really have anything like that. I'm sure he was there for the fight scenes and the choreographs and stuff. But, like, usually there's some kind of, like, press beforehand. Like, oh, Tom Cruise did all of this in whatever movie that he's in.
Tackled a guy off a roof, I guess. Like,
I guess.
That's the big scene.
Yeah, it's just not quite as impressive this time around. I did think the standout in this movie to me is Colby Smulders, who is arguably the actual lead character of this story. She is the Furiosa to Reacher's Mad Max, if you will.
No, you're right in terms of their relationship, but in terms of what Furiosa got in Mad Max and what Colby Smulders actually gets in this movie, because that was one of my, like, they make a point to make Colby Smulders' character on equal footing in terms of, like, hand-to-hand combat. You know, they're fighting each other. Like, they're with Jack Reacher, they're on the same caliber, sort of. We have a whole scene where she gets into an argument with Jack Reacher over, you know, I've had to put up with this shit my whole career, men like you, blah, blah, blah. And she makes a really awesome point, and then it just kind of doesn't go anywhere else. Like, they don't – I feel like her being given that scene doesn't add anything. Like, she – I don't know.
No,
it didn't go far enough, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I very much agree with that. You know, I think, like, first of all, kudos to Tom Cruise, at least, for making female protagonists, like, the focal point of his recent movies. Right. You know, with Emily Blunt in Edge of Tomorrow, Rebecca Ferguson in Mission Impossible 5, and now Kobe Smulders here. I think that's at least admirable in that respect. But yeah, there's like the movie takes the time to convey a very important message about sexism, right. which felt like a little much. And, you know, I like the idea of using that as like a theme for Smulders' character. But her speech just kind of felt like someone writing an essay about the subject rather than like a character expressing their feelings.
Especially considering Tom Cruise is also yelling back at her over her speaking that dialogue.
yeah,
so it was weird. And I guess the end, there's the big climactic fight with the villain, and Kobe Smulders isn't given anything to do. Like,
this is true. Yeah,
it's the big climax after we've had this argument, this speech she gives, and then she doesn't get to do anything. So it just felt counterproductive to itself.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I thought the editing seemed kind of off in places, and in others just kind of felt rushed. There's, you know, we go from one sequence to the next without much indication of how we got there. I think, you know, if there was like a more careful editing job, it would kind of help certain jokes land. So like there's that bit where Smulders compliments like a cab driver's hat.
Right.
And in the next cut, you see her wearing the hat. Right. And yeah. It's supposed to be like a little joke, like, oh, now like the cab driver gave her a hat, whatever. But the timing felt very off. Like it needed an extra beat in that thing for the site to land. Because as it is, she says like, oh, that's a nice hat. Like, are you a fan of that team? And he's like, oh yeah, my whole life. But it almost cuts him off like mid sentence, like mid word.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is the middle of the sentence. Yeah.
And it like cuts to the next scene and you see Smulders wearing the hat. And that could be a pretty solid joke if there was maybe like an extra beat there, like an extra second before you cut it away, or like maybe an extra line of dialogue or something. Like, I feel like there's something there to that, that just felt like off in execution.
Yeah. There's also a couple cuts where, excuse me, there's the running joke of, you know, it's Tom Cruise, the running is every movie.
Yeah,
where like literally they're in a car driving and they're like, we need to ditch the car. And they cut to and then sprinting across the field.
Yeah. If you love watching Tom Cruise running, Jack Reacher Never Go Back is the movie for you. It happens like three or four times, throughout. And then like the entire climax is centered on Tom Cruise running as well. So there was that, at least. I do enjoy watching Tom Cruise run. It's just funny to me.
Like, yeah, it's just become a joke at this point.
I'll throw this out there. Kid sidekicks in action movies are almost never a good idea. And Jack Reacher Never Go Back is no exception. Danica Yosh's character, Sam, incredibly annoying in this movie. I think everything that character did was kind of the worst. I feel like, you know, she is just kind of this black hole of charisma.
Yeah, unfortunately.
It kind of sucks the movie down, and it kind of weakens the Jack Reacher character just by her being there, and we'll talk about why that is in spoilers. But, you know...
Yeah, she is given the opportunity to progress the plot in some way. A couple times, actually, now that I think about it. But yeah, as a performance, not so hot.
Yeah, I mean, even then, I feel like her performance isn't great, but also, like, you know, every decision that character made felt like it was the kind of decision that had to be made for the plot to move along, rather than for what would make sense for that character. And specifically,
right,
leading into the climax was super egregious, and we'll talk about that in spoilers, but, like, it was really, really bad. And the cast in general just seems kind of, like, blander this time around, right?
Yeah.
Like the last movie, you know, you had Rosamund Pike playing the female lead. You had Richard Jenkins. You had David Oyelowo. Freaking Werner Herzog. Robert Duvall was in Jack Reacher. And like, yeah, Jai Courtney was there too, but still, like...
Oh, man.
I got to get my Courtney slams in somewhere.
He's the Charlie Hunnam of Jack Reacher movies.
But, like, still, that's a damn solid cast right there. That's, you know, recognizable faces. And I don't necessarily need recognizable faces, but, like, people who are distinctive. And that's what the Jack Reacher cast had. I feel like this movie had Jack Reacher, Kobe Smulders, Danica Yorosha's Sam, and then like a bunch of like same looking military dudes.
Yep. And then that one guy from Prison Break.
Yeah, sure. Same looking military dudes and same looking criminal dudes. Like they're all kind of look the same. You can only tell the difference because some of them have military uniforms on. So you can tell they're military dudes. And you know, I feel like the action also kind of took a back seat in this movie to the investigation this time around. Like this movie felt like it was more about like investigating, trying to get into, and there's like action scenes peppered throughout, but there's not as much of a focus on that as there was in the first movie, which struck a pretty good balance between, you know, the action and the Law and Order stuff.
Yeah, and for some reason this one didn't, the investigation aspect of it didn't even really seem to be anything.
Like, I saw the movie a couple days ago and I don't remember anything about what the investigation was, like what like what the plot of the movie was, what they were investigating, something to do with like two people who died in Afghanistan who were under Kobe Smolder's watch or something.
Yeah, the investigation in this one is the two people die in Afghanistan and they're trying to figure out with smuggling guns, but it's not just guns. There's other stuff happening.
Something to do with drugs or whatever. Like, and at a certain point, like I was checked out. I didn't really care. And like, I don't remember the investigation in the first Jack Reacher being that great either. But that movie had a lot more going for it. Like it had a lot of action, like a lot more invented action scenes and had a cool set piece. I mean, that car chase in the first one is so good. And ends on like such a perfect note when Tom Cruise goes in the bus, and the guy gives Tom Cruise a hat to, you know,
right.
Like that's a movie that had a hat joke that landed.
Yeah. You know? It almost makes it feel like we're supposed to remember that hat joke.
Yeah. It sort of feels like a callback to that hat joke but like it doesn't like explicitly make it. I don't know. But that also has like the opening sequence with the sniper rifle. Like you're watching it through the scope of the sniper. It's a really effective and chilling sequence. You know, you have the big climax that has to do at the Zek, that's Werner Herzog's character's name, the Zek, is like hiding out with Rosamund Pike held hostage, and he has to like infiltrate this house. You know, there's the gun range scene with Robert Duvall. There's a lot of good stuff in Jack Reacher, and this doesn't have that as much.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know. What else did you want to talk about, Mike? Or should we get into spoilers?
I think we'll just go straight to spoilers. We're pretty middle of the road, I think.
Yeah, pretty middle of the road on Jack Reacher: Never Go Back. There is some good stuff in here. Like it's not, like if you want to just watch Tom Cruise punching people, this movie will oblige.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kobe Smulders, I think, is good in the movie. Like, she's a fun action hero presence. But, again, she doesn't – like, I feel like she doesn't get anything that's more interesting than, say, she gets in the Marvel movies, right, with the – as.
Yeah, you're totally right. But just, like, the size of her character in the Marvel movies versus the size of her character in
that's the thing. She's the co-lead of this movie. And in the Marvel movie, she's, like, ninth build. And I feel like even in those movies, like she gets more interesting dialogue, and she gets she doesn't even get that many action scenes in the Marvel movies. I feel like there's a scene in the first Avengers movie where she's like shooting at the Hulk, and that's like it, right? Like she's mostly standing around a computer. And even then, I feel like she's a better action hero in the Marvel movies than she is in Jack Reacher 2. I would very much like to see Kobe Smulders get like a real action hero role at some point. In any case, let's move on to spoilers, Mike, for Jack Reacher: Never Go Back.
Stop it! Both of you! You're spoiling everything!
Alright, spoilers for Jack Reacher: Never Go Back starting right now. So, Sam, the Danica Yosha character, is kind of played up throughout the movie as potentially being Jack Reacher's daughter. And I very much disliked everything to do with that. I thought that was I thought that was lousy. It felt like the kind of thing you would do in like a fourth or fifth Jack Reacher movie, not the second one. You know, and this is, however, based on the 18th novel in the series. I'll throw that out there.
So there's that.
There is that. But still, like it's the second movie. You can change things around, do other things.
Right.
You know, I feel like it kind of weakens Reacher as a character. Like it kind of. We're supposed to kind of treat him as like a deadbeat dad for most of the movie.
It feels real weird considering that's kind of the whole appeal, I think, of Jack Reacher is this drifter action hero. Yeah,
unattached to anything. Like,
yeah, basically man with no name type guy.
He's man with no name. He's Mad Max. Like, you know, like both of these movies are Jack Reacher wandering into a situation that he had no involvement in beforehand and getting himself tangled up with it and helping people get out of the situation, much like in Mad Max or much like The Man with No Name. And I like that about the character. I like that aspect of the character. And I like this movie at least is a standalone action story.
Right.
You know, it doesn't connect back to the first one in any meaningful way, and it doesn't set up a sequel in any meaningful way, unless the sequel happens to have, like, Sam as his sidekick again. Like, I don't
right. know. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you on that. That there's it could have been something really cool, but to ground him in being this asshole, like, it seems like a weird character development to make.
Right. And then towards the end of the movie, it turns out he's not her father, because he didn't recognize her mother when they were at the diner together. So that's that. Like, I feel like, why do we even go through this? You know, I feel like it would have been more interesting if that wasn't even in play, but Sam was there, and, like, you kind of have, like, a father-daughter relationship kind of build with Reacher and Sam, like, as the movie goes on, like, even though they're not related or anything. And I feel like the movie sort of plays around with that, but I feel like by adding the question, like, oh, is Reacher Sam's father, you kind of ruin that. Like, because it becomes about, like, oh, is he really your father? Instead of, like, oh, these two have a mentor-mentee relationship.
Yeah, it becomes more of a relationship out of obligation for a long part of this movie.
Yeah.
Until at the end, oh, it's not. They're actually friends. It's like, what?
Also, Sam gets over her foster parents' death, like, pretty damn quick.
Like, real quick.
Like, immediately. I don't think she even sheds a tear about them, actually. She seems a little bit upset in the car afterwards.
Yeah. They were two cool old hippies. And then that's kind of it.
Who would ever want to hurt them? Then we'll never mention them again. I do. The best sequence in this movie is probably the scene in which Reacher breaks Smulders out of jail. To me, that was probably the standout action scene. The two play off each other very well. You know, I like Tom Cruise and Cobie Smulders together. I think the two of them are good foils for each other. And I think there is a better action movie to be made with these characters. Unfortunately, this is not it.
Right. Yeah, it has been a while since I've seen the first Jack Reacher, so I did like all the like, his investigative mind thing, like, what, like, he'll see a scene, you know, like, he'll go into detective mode, I guess, to put it in, like, video game terms.
Put it in Batman Arkham Asylum terms.
Yeah, like, he'll walk into a scene and, you know, be able to see the layout of the room and everything, and we get that with the prison, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, him figuring out the timing of the doors and everything. So that was fun. That sequence was really cool. There's a solid joke there that I do think is cool with the, what kind of car would a lawyer drive? And black sedan. And they pan out into a parking lot of black sedans.
Yes, like, that was pretty funny. And, like, there's other sequences. Like, I mentioned a couple that were in the trailer, but, like, there's, like, the scene at the very beginning of the movie where Jack Reacher's, like, alone in a diner, and, like, a cop shows up, and, you know, he's, like, Jack Reacher has just punched out a bunch of dudes. Cop's going to arrest Jack Reacher. And then Jack Reacher's like, two things are going to happen in the next 30 seconds. That phone's going to ring, and you're going to be wearing these cuffs. And, you know, then that happens. And it's like, ah, yeah, it's cool, badass, like, reintroduction to Jack Reacher, like, a fun character moment. There's also the scene where he's in the diner, and he sees the two guys, like, spying on him from across the street. And he walks over to them and, like, taps in the window. And it's like, hey. And then he punches through the window to punch the guy.
With the salt shaker.
Yes.
Like, sure.
So, like, that's fun. That's fun stuff. But I feel like, you know, there's not enough there to really recommend this movie, which is a shame, because Jack Reacher 1 is so good. Like, it's such a fun time. The thing is, I would watch a third Jack Reacher.
Probably.
Yeah. Like, I feel like there's enough to hang a franchise on here. And, you know, even Mission Impossible, like, Mission Impossible 2 is widely regarded as not very good, but it kept going and it became awesome. So,
yeah.
I will say the final action scene, which I wanted to talk about before, is only initiated because Sam is a complete idiot.
I wanted to just talk about her. Yeah.
And she, she's hiding out in the hotel where Reacher and Smulders have stayed. And they paid cash only for a very specific reason, because they don't want to use the stolen credit card on the hotel room so that people can easily trace them. And then, you know, Reacher and Smulders are gone, doing some action movie stuff, and then you cut back to Sam. She's at the hotel. She's a little upset because she's had to wait a little longer than she expected, and she's very hungry. So she calls room service and orders it on the credit card, the stolen credit card that she herself stole. She knows it's stolen.
Yep.
And as soon as she does that, they're immediately traced, which, you know, initiates the final action scene where the guys come in to try to attack Sam. Dumb. Super, super dumb. Like, that's the kind of decision that you yell at people in the theater for. Like, you hear people in the theater yelling, like, you can't be this stupid. Like, you just can't be.
Yeah, and it totally undercuts the scene before that with Sam that I was, like, she's shown to be capable in some weird way. Like, we see she sneaks out in the middle of the night and she goes to the whatever and she finds out where the homeless veterans hang out with the junkies, and she is shown to be super street smart and aware of, you know, you go for the alpha guy because they all have little sisters or they want one. Like, she knows what's going on, and there's like a clever moment there, only to just be undercut by her sheer stupidity. Like, like, it doesn't make any sense.
Ah, man.
Especially because it all those scenes all happen after the Colby Smulders, like, argument with Tom Cruise's character. Like,
right, about the very important message about sexism.
Yeah, like, it has that, like, it, and then it undercuts itself. And then, like I said, in the final climax chase scene parade thing, oh man, I can't remember the James Bond movie. Did better. That just came out.
Spectre.
Spectre, yeah.
It reminded me of Spectre as well. The opening scene of Spectre. And I also did want to mention that there's a scene about halfway, like when they get to the hotel, there's a scene of Colby Smulders training Sam.
Right.
Which I remember when, like, that training sequence happened. I'm like, oh man, I picked it out immediately. I was like, that's going to come back in the finale at some point. like that move that she just taught her. But here's the thing that does come back in the finale. It's a move where, you know, somebody has a gun on her and you can, like, kind of maneuver under the arm and, like, knock the gun away. And then they do that. Like, they have the training sequence and Tom Cruise has, like, some badass line, like, if that's your only move, you're already dead or something like that.
Right.
And then, you know, they get a little miffed and Colby Smulders like, all right, let's add a kick to the balls in the mix. and that's kind of funny. But then they do that move later on in the finale. She doesn't kick him in the balls.
Yeah. Like, yeah, no. She does that move only to just let Jack Reacher then finish the fight. She's removed of her agency at that.
That would have been such a satisfying kick to the balls.
Yeah,
because it was built up earlier in the movie that she would kick somebody in the balls and then she doesn't.
Yep.
I don't know. You could say that Jack Reacher Never Go Back has blue balls.
Son of a bitch.
And on that note, I feel like we
did it.
We've wrapped it up.
Yeah. You've got nothing left to say now.
All right, so not a big fan of Jack Reacher 2, unfortunately. I was really looking forward to Jack Reacher 2, man, because I loved the first one. And I had hoped, like, you know, Cruise basically has creative control over these movies.
Right.
Like most action movies that Cruise does, he basically has most of the control. And so when Chris McQuarrie left, I was hoping, like, you know, somebody cool would jump on. And, like, the fact that he brought on Ed Zwick himself, you know, because Ed Zwick directed Last Samurai, all right, like, you know, I can get behind this, but it fell completely flat. Disappointing. Yep. But if they get Chris McQuarrie back for Jack Reacher, then I am in.
That's your new campaign?
I can't envision a universe where that's not the title of Jack Reacher 3. Jack Reacher.
It's gotta be.
Chris McQuarrie for Jack Reacher, or somebody else who's really good. You know, I'm happy with anybody, but you know, just somebody who can deliver a really solid action movie. It's what I want out of Jack Reacher. But in any case, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. You can also follow along with my Walking Dead live tweets at #MikingDead. and if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
That is a brilliant hashtag, by the way. You can follow me on twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, and you can find all my podcast stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DeCrescio. If you are listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you were emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you, and if you want to contribute to Filmbook's Patreon campaign, you can go ahead and do that too at patreon.com/filmbook. Join us in 2 weeks, where we will be discussing a documentary about a weird podiatrist.
I'm not sure that's what it is.
Are you sure? Doctor Strange. I don't know. He's a weird doctor, right? A weird podiatrist.
That's
how
what
great.
It is.
How great would it be if Doctor Strange was a podiatrist instead of a surgeon?
That'd be my favorite thing
if
ever.
If he had no magic powers and he's just a podiatrist.
Just a Werner Herzog movie.
All right, and you can check out our next complete works. We're going to be talking Nicolas Cage's role in Con Air. Very excited about that, Mike.
Oh yeah. It's going to be the best. Hopefully, it will be almost as good as The Rock.
Hopefully. We'll see.
Or our as good as an hour episode of The Rock.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we already know it's as good as The Rock.
Yeah. That's what I'm getting.
Yeah. So hopefully, yeah. I mean, our The Rock episode is pretty top-notch, so who knows?
We may have peaked.
Not to toot our own horn or anything like that, but The Rock episode was pretty good. If you want to check that out, you can do that at filmbook.com or on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever podcasts are sold. yeah, we're going to be doing Con Air next. Very excited about that. It's going to be a lot of fun. So thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.
Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile, you'd buy expensive shoes.